The first few weeks back at school set the tone for the entire year. But with new teachers, schedules, and expectations, it can feel like a lot. If you're looking to help your child start strong and stay confident, I've been using IXL to make that transition so much easier. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, it adapts to each child's level and pace, making it easy to spot and close learning gaps in just a few minutes a day before those gaps can snowball. Plus, it's trusted nationwide. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL, and it's used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. It's an easy, cost-effective way to get kids back into a learning routine and walking into class feeling ready and reassured. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. Listeners can get an exclusive 20% off an IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLlearning.com/audio. Visit IXLlearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
The right window treatments change everything. Your sleep, your privacy, the way every room looks and feels. At Blinds.com, we've spent 30 years making it surprisingly simple to get exactly what your home needs. We've covered over 25 million windows and have 50,000 five-star reviews to prove we deliver. Whether you DIY it or want a pro to handle everything from measure to install, we have you covered. Real design professionals, free samples, zero pressure. Right now, get up to 50% off with minimum purchase. Plus, get a free professional measure at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I'm your host, Nick Agar-Johnson, and just as a little heads up, we are pre-recording these episodes, so if anything drastic changes about some of the players that we're going to talk about today, then that will not be accounted for, but hopefully this is a bit more of an evergreen podcast, so slightly different from the usual Deep Dives fare, but I am here with someone who has not been on this very podcast in quite a long time, and I'm very happy to have him back. So, Nathan Gribble. Nathan, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing well, Nick. I'm certainly thankful that you're having me on for such a special episode or group of episodes as we're going to talk about. So, haven't been on Deep Dives for a little bit, but I'm sure I'm going to be making more of the podcast rounds as the year goes on in the No Ceilings feed. I've done an episode with Corey, episode with Maxwell. You're next on the list. We'll see if the two Tylers eventually want to have me on or if they just want me to stay as far away from their podcast feed as possible. So
I'll take a bronze medal. That's fine by me.
No, but we always have fun when we do podcasts. Nick, we spend a lot of time last series of podcasts that I was on covering a lot of NBA topics, going into a lot of what I was doing with Ricky Ladderwork. So I'm sure we're going to find a fair bit of NBA crossover and be discussing some topics that I've certainly tried to broach on my end with a lot of the work I'm doing for No Ceilings over Youth Movement NBA. So I'm excited to break away from the standard draft fare and talk a little pro basketball with you and see what kind of common threads we can pull apart as far as archetypes and all that fun stuff.
Wow, you're stepping right over the intro. This is perfect. So the idea for this podcast and the next one and potentially future ones, depending on how things go slash how much Nathan can tolerate having to deal with me on a podcast. So this is going to be more NBA focused. So, you know, as you mentioned, more sort of related to the No Ceilings work you've been doing this year. And it's sort of a 5-year prospect retrospective. So now that we are in the year 2025, which is insane to say, I feel ancient just having those words spill out of my mouth. I just wanted to sort of think about how the draft landscape has changed over the past 10 years. And so I'm saying 5-year prospect retrospective because we're essentially going to break this down into, you know, the 2016 to 2020 range of drafts, the 2021 to 2024, I guess, range of drafts, and then sort of talk about how some of the prospects in this year's class break down in terms of some of the sort of changes in the NBA that we're seeing, because something that you have talked quite a bit about this year and something that I think is very important for all scouts to keep in mind is the league that we're scouting for, right? You know, we're not, the two of us are not Ignacio. We're not, you know, scouting for international leagues / G leagues. And so in that sense, you know, as you've said, again, this is your corner that I'm stepping on a bit, but, you know, I think it's a very important corner that it's important to sort of evaluate what has worked and what has not worked in the NBA in recent times and what has sort of changed over the course of the NBA lifetimes of some of these prospects. So we're going to start with today's episode, part one, talking about guards, and then we will have part two coming out next week talking about wings, and then, you know, potential future episodes on forwards and centers. But starting with the guards, I think there's been two sort of major landscape shifts. And I want to start with the first one because I think it's the most prevalent, which is the move away from smaller guards. And this is a corner that our colleague Maxwell Baumbach has been on for quite a while. But, you know, I think it's important to discuss that, you know, even, well, the 2016 draft is maybe not the best example at the top, given that a 6'10 point guard in Ben Simmons was the number one overall pick. But, you know, just sort of general league-wide trends, you know, there's been sort of a shift away from the quote-unquote pure point guard, which, you know, oftentimes would be where there's 6 foot, 6'1 guards sort of settled in. You know, there were the Lou Williamses of the world, you know, certainly more of those kinds of players than there are now. But, you know, there used to be a lot more of a home for sort of a smaller point guard who was just an exceptional passer, who ran the offense, who didn't make mistakes. And, you know, it's funny that we're starting with the 2016 draft because, you know, Ben Simmons is a big example of one of the sort of big point guards that we've seen a lot of in recent years. But just sort of generally throughout the draft, it's been a trend where if you're a smaller guard, you have to be both a spectacular scorer and a spectacular passer. You can't just be the pure point guard type anymore. Chris Paul is obviously the exception to every sort of these kinds of rules, but generally speaking, that's been sort of a trend that I've noticed. What are your thoughts on that sort of move away from smaller guards? And do you think there is still room for, you know, maybe more of a scoring small guard archetype, the Lou Williamses of the world, the CJ McCollums of the world?
I want to take a little bit of time to push back slightly on the quote unquote small guards proposition. And the only reason why I'm doing that, it's nothing personal towards Nick or any of the other scouts in the space. But when we say small guards, I'm going to assume that that means below average size of an NBA guard, which if you take a look at the landscape of the league, I've done this over numerous different years and different ranges of time within the NBA. But on average, you're coming out somewhere about 6'3", 190 pounds, right, is the average size of a guard in the NBA. And again, when I say guard, I'm categorizing positions based on a few factors, one of them being who are you best suited to obviously defend on the opposite side in the NBA? And then from an offensive sense, where are you operating most from in terms of responsibilities and spots on the floor? So guards, in my mind, are guys who are typically bringing the ball up the floor. They're one of the first to usually touch the basketball in terms of either they're bringing it up or they're immediately coming off another action to catch the ball up on the wing or at the top of the key. And then defensively, they're defending other backcourt players, right? They're defending other guys who are responsible for setting up the offense or bringing up the ball or navigating through tight windows. So that's how I look at a guard. But even using that construct of quote unquote small guards, how I grade players, I currently have 30 NBA guards that I've graded as a sixth man or better who are 6'3" or under in the NBA. And 10 of them are all-star caliber or better by how I look and evaluate players. Steph Curry, Ja Morant, Jalen Brunson, Tyrese Maxey, Trae Young, Donovan Mitchell, Kyrie Irving, Damian Lillard, De'Aaron Fox, Darius Garland. I know there are some guys on that list who technically are before the eras of time that we're looking at right now, sticking between 2015 and 2025. But for the most part, a lot of those guys were actually drafted in that range. Some of them were drafted accordingly. Some of them were drafted certainly not accordingly in relation to the types of talents that they actually are and the players who they are today. But I want to keep that in mind, that this idea that small guards can't exist or aren't up to a certain caliber of player in the NBA, I think we have to catch ourselves when we talk about that a little bit, because it's what I've found is that size doesn't necessarily impact the ceiling of that certain position. Now, positional size and athletic tools can cap ceilings on other positions. And when I say cap ceilings, I mean the highest levels of outcomes, right? But when generally across history at the guard position, we've had plenty of guys who are 6 foot, 6'1", 6'2", 6'3", end up being stars. Not all of them are necessarily leading their teams to championships and are the face of a franchise like a Steph Curry, but certainly second, third options, important cogs when we're talking about championship cultures and championship cores. Again, I don't think that size necessarily defines that position the way it does other positions. That's just my sort of soapbox moment for this podcast, Nick. I'll answer your question. I don't know if you had any pushback to what I said before I actually answer the real question that you asked me.
No, I think it's a very important point to bring up. I guess sort of the way I was trying to think of framing it is you have to be spectacular as a smaller guard, and you have to have not just, I guess what I was more talking about is sort of the pure point guard type, right? The, you know, Chris Paul is not even a good example because, you know, he had seasons where he was like 20 point a game scorer, right? I mean, like just the pure sort of game manager point guard types. I mean, there's a particular prospect that I'm thinking of in regards to this, which is I was a huge fan of Iverson Molinar during his draft year because he was someone who just didn't make mistakes, who ran the offense at an incredibly high level and was a solid scorer, but he wasn't a special scorer. And like when you go down the list of players that you just mentioned, most of them are both incredible scorers and incredible passers, but there's none of them that, like, you're not seeing anybody at that spot who's, say, a 6'1 guard who's averaging more assists than points, right? It's like you have to be a high level scorer and a good passer to make it as a smaller guard. And also, as you mentioned, you know, there are a lot of point guards that fall under that realm. But, you know, in terms of the sort of Lou Williams off guard at 6'1 types, I feel like those players are being sort of phased out of the league because you have to hide them on defense and they have to at least be able to provide you with some playmaking for others in addition to being able to be high level scorers.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
I've always dreamed of being able to order my coffee in Italian like a local, instead of just pointing at the menu and hoping for the best. There's something about speaking another language with real confidence that opens up a whole new world of experiences. That's why I'm so excited about Rosetta Stone Sapphire. It's their biggest launch in over a decade. It takes that research-backed method we all know and trust and adds fresh, cutting-edge features that make it easier than ever to go from knowing a few phrases to speaking naturally about the topics you actually care about. What I love is that you aren't just memorizing vocabulary lists. You learn entirely in your new language through visuals and audio, just like you did as a kid. One of my favorite new features is chat missions. It turns conversation practice into a game, putting you in real-world scenarios, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions, and giving you missions to complete. You get real-time feedback along the way, so you build that confidence before you ever have to use your skills in the real world. If you want to take your language skills to the next level, don't wait to try Rosetta Stone Sapphire. Listeners of this podcast can get 20% off their Rosetta Stone Sapphire subscription when they sign up today. This gets you access to Rosetta Stone Sapphire in 25 languages. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10 to redeem your 20% off. That's rosettastone.com/rs10.
No, 100%. I just think the threshold in general for where we're at in the NBA today, the bar is just set so much higher, right? Like you're no longer on the floor just solely to do one thing. You are at bare minimum doing 2 to 3 things at a high level. And ideally, if you are competing for a championship, like how the Boston Celtics or the Oklahoma City Thunder are set up, you're doing nearly everything you need to on the floor, right? This whole idea of it's not even just dribble, pass, shoot anymore. It's also dribble, pass, shoot, defend. And when you're falling short in multiple of those areas, you're quote unquote capping a ceiling on yourself, right? It's not necessarily just about doing that one thing very well and having that be the thing that can carry you through a career. That one thing can get you on the court, it can get you minutes, but how do you evolve off of that one thing, right? If you are someone who has elite vision and you are someone who can see things 1, 2, 3 steps ahead of the defense, you're able to make those passes and make those reads, that's one skill, right? But the other part to that, and kind of like what you're talking about in terms of, you know, balance within the role of a player, is you also have to be a threat to score. And I think a lot of that's because we're not in an era of basketball where a lot of those traditional table setting point guards were bringing the ball up the floor. They were obviously low mistake, low turnover players, but their primary duty was to get the ball to an isolation score or a post score. That's not necessarily how the NBA flows best nowadays, right? We're seeing that with a lot of teams where, you know, a team like Boston doesn't necessarily have this dominant scorer who's going to take, you know, 30 to 40 shots by himself. Obviously, Jason Tatum is the primary scoring option. And in a lot of ways, he's also become a primary facilitator for that team. So see, there you go. There's another player at a different position, but he's doing both of those things at the same time, right? But you're seeing a lot more team balanced basketball to where it's about who can crack a defense, who can penetrate, who can cause, you know, scrambles and switches and displaced defenders so that they can kick the ball to the next place. And then that guy can kick the ball to where it needs to go after that to ultimately capitalize on that advantage that was created by that initial breakdown. So in order to break down a defense, it's not just about your ability to pass. You have to be a threat to score the basketball. You have to be a threat to where if you get that first step on a defender and you get downhill, you're a threat to score at the rim, or you're a threat to score in the mid-range off of like a floater or a runner, or you're able to take space and pull up on balance for a mid-range jump shot, or you're coming off a screen and if the defense makes a mistake, they don't go over, they go under, you're a threat to shoot the three-point shot. I just think it's that idea of you need to be a threat to both score and pass as a guard wasn't necessarily the solid truth in previous eras, but in the game today, it's so paramount that you aren't just only relying on one skill. You need to have a balanced skill set. So that kind of answers your question about pass first guards. When you're talking about the off guard, right? Like the CJ McCollums and the Lou Williams of old, to where, you know, they are a bit undersized for a two position, or that's kind of honestly gone away and been categorized more as a 2-3 or a wing position. They're undersized there. You know, they're likely going up against on defense another guy who's at that wing position if they're playing alongside another guard who is going to be guarding someone else in that backcourt, right? The quote unquote point guard. So when we're talking about these positional overlaps, that's where defense comes more into play, because if you're asking Lou Williams, someone who's 6'1", 6'2", to go guard a 6'6", 6'7" off-ball player who can not only move without the basketball, but even when they get the basketball, if they're attacking on a closeout, you know, or they're just going up against somebody one-on-one, they're a much more bigger, much more physical player. They can push someone like Lou Williams off the spot. And, you know, in that one-on-one situation, sure. And then you have all the different ways where defenses are capitalizing on mismatches and running screening actions to make sure that they're getting the best of the other team's worst defender. That's kind of where the size comes into play, and where that's an area where we can take the undersized argument, because on defense, you know, especially when you get deep in the playoffs, it's all about how can you capitalize on the other team's worst defenders. And if you have a weak spot, whether that's at the point guard spot, the off guard spot, you know, that's why we're seeing a lot more emphasis on how can some of these guards, it's not necessarily just about what they do offensively, can they at least hold up on defense? And they are a complete liability for the other team. But, you know, a lot of point guards traditionally, Nick, they aren't, you and I both know they aren't necessarily all world defenders. There are certainly some exceptions to that rule, but the guys around them, right? Like point guards are on the floor to be offensive engines. The guys around them need to at least be able to hold their own defensively, or else they're much more inclined to lose their minutes, especially if they're like a 6'2", 6'3 guard next to a point guard. They're much more inclined to lose their minutes to someone who's 6'6", 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", who can also dribble the ball a little bit, at least attack closeouts, and ultimately shoot the three ball and defend their position.
So you mentioned the dribble, pass, shoot, defend thing and how guards these days have to check three of the four boxes. So I want to talk about one of my favorite archetypes that's emerged over the last, it feels like it's only been really the last 5 years, even though technically a couple of names I'm going to bring up were drafted slightly earlier, but the sort of rarest version of that three of four, the player who dribbles, passes, defends, can't shoot. So I've listed this as the Gary Payton II and the Bruce Brown archetype, because those small sets fascinate me. And something that has been a lot more common in the NBA in the last 5 years is guard setting screens for other players, like guard setting cross screens. And, you know, Kyle Lowry is someone who is exceptional at this, which is funny because he's one of these 6-0 guards, right? But, you know, I think that's an archetype where, you know, if the idea is sort of the evolution of the 4-out offense, right? That the 1-in could be a guard, especially if they're the kind of defensive player and connector that both Gary Payton II and Bruce Brown can be. So first of all, how much room do you think there is for those kinds of guards, given the emphasis on shooting in the modern NBA? And, you know, second of all, what are your thoughts on that archetype, just generally as sort of the NBA landscape evolves?
It is as unique of an archetype as there is across the league. And when I'm talking about that, like you mentioned Gary Payton, you mentioned Bruce Brown, I would throw Russell Westbrook in that same camp as well. But at least as Russell Westbrook has, you know, certainly gotten into the later part of his career, he's not quite the same on-ball dynamic force that he once was, to where he's not being utilized in some of those same ways. Although you watched Russell Westbrook, who's actually tore it up the other night without Nikola Jokic on the floor, I guess that's an exception to that. But when we're talking about those types of players, it's a tough archetype to try and pinpoint and something to look at in potential future draft classes, because it takes two to tango, right? Yeah. When I say that, like in all of those constructs, who are those guys playing off of? The two names that come to mind are Nikola Jokic and Draymond Green. Sure. And those are two of the most special basketball players that we've ever seen in history. So when we're talking about those types of guys, yes, it takes their willingness. It takes their physicality at that position. These guys are not scrawny. They are built very well for guards. They're very strong. They're tough-nosed. They're team first. That's what they're out there to do on the floor. And then the skill sets kind of fall along with that. They're obviously guys who can dribble and pass. And the thing I want to capitalize on, though, with that is that we're looking at them as non-shooters. And yet, when you take a look at two of the guys who you mentioned, Bruce Brown and Gary Payton, they're still career average about 33-34% from three. So it's not like we can talk about them as they were like 25% from three non-shooters either. I think that's where the NBA has sort of forced those guys to evolve, where Bruce Brown wasn't always the best shooter in his career. During his best years with Denver, he became enough of a three-point shooter to where defenses had to respect him, right? If he ended up being the pop guy in those inverted screen actions with Nikola Jokic, defenses had to respect that. It wasn't always just Bruce Brown rolling to the rim or Bruce Brown out of the dunker spot. There were possessions where he would be the pop guy and he would be able to knock down those three-point shots, similar to like a Gary Payton. And Russell Westbrook has not been a good shooter for basically his entire career, but on his best nights, even in a construct like with Denver, or when he had some of his best nights when he was most recently with the Clippers, like Russell was still finding ways to knock down open threes when defenses left him open. So I think when we talk about that type of player, yes, those are very unique guys, but even in those types of constructs where coaches have to be a little more outside of the box when trying to game plan and utilize them to their strengths offensively, they still have to bring something to the table from a shooting standpoint in order to get, you know, 20, 25, 30 minutes on the floor. Because if they can't shoot at all, if you can't shoot at all on an NBA floor at this point, you are not playable, especially as you get later in the season in the playoffs.
I'm glad that you pushed back a little bit, but I do want to push back a little bit on your pushback, which is they both they're not 25% shooters, as you mentioned, but Gary Payton II has never taken more than 1.5 threes a game in his entire NBA career. Bruce Brown had that 1 year with Denver and that 1 year with Indiana above three, but he still averages fewer than 2 3-point attempts per game. In terms of where they sat most of the time offensively, they were spending more time in the dunker spot than they were spacing out to the 3-point line. So yeah, I mean, unless you're sort of the prototypical rim protecting big, everybody, I think, has to be able to shoot to some extent. But I mean, these were not high volume 3-point shooters. These are not high volume 3-point shooters. They were mostly being, you know, screen and dive type guys or sitting in the dunker spot. You know, again, they weren't entirely non-shooters, so that's a very fair point to bring up. But they weren't exactly prolific from distance in terms of
sure, how many shots they were sure. But again, who were those guys playing with, though? Right, we're talking about Nikola Jokic and Draymond Green, and how many other teams in the NBA have guys like that, where a lot of their dirty work is coming as, you know, heavy usage offensive hubs, you know, at the top of the key near the free throw line, to where you're actually leaving someone space in the dunker spot as a guard to operate within that type of offensive construct, right? Like, how many teams are actually able to capitalize on having someone like that in their system? You know, those are very, very special situations and very special types of players. I think it's an interesting archetype. And I'm glad you gravitate towards that and you watch that as a basketball appreciator. I can certainly respect that. I just think it's very, very unique, and it's not something that I'm actively looking for or actively questioning myself when I'm evaluating a player, certainly in more recent drafts and even for 2025. You know, can someone play the Bruce Brown, Gary Payton type role? Because the odds of that role even being available to the team that drafts them are very, very, very slim.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And, you know, I think a very relevant thing to point out here is that Bruce Brown went 42nd overall and Gary Payton II went undrafted, right? It's not like NBA teams are particularly valuing that archetype highly. I think it honestly might just say more about those players who are like, okay, what else can I figure out to stay on the floor?
Oh, absolutely. And I remember evaluating Bruce Brown before his draft. I saw him play in person during the Lonnie Walker days when they were at Miami. And I remember thinking, like, I don't think this guy can shoot. I'm not in love with his decision-making. I get that he's a plus athlete. I get that he's strong, he's physical, he's tough, but I don't know if I want to bet on this guy to make it in the NBA. Like, some people are talking about him like he's a potential first round pick. And I don't know if I want to give this guy that grade. And Bruce Brown certainly proved me wrong, right? Like, there's no way about it. Like, you look at his career and he's had the career of a first round pick, someone who stuck around the league for quite a while. So I think what you just said, the last point to really cap on is that, yeah, that them succeeding, it yes, I brought up the point that obviously you needed a special construct to give them room to play and give them room to succeed, and it's required special talents around them. But it is a credit to themselves that they've figured out the type of role that they need to play in the NBA in order to succeed. And they've sort of ditched whatever they hung their hat on offensively at lower levels, where they had physical advantages, where they could be higher usage guys, you know, a lot of the ball in their hands, driving at defenders and able to capitalize on those types of advantages. When they don't have those options in front of them and defenses are able to take some of those strengths away, how else can they attack an NBA defense and how can they play to that role? And there are examples like them. I mean, in a different way, it makes me think of another guard slash wing and Quentin Grimes, right? When we mm-hmm. evaluated him at Kansas, he was looked at as a point guard, as a on-ball guy, and that experiment fizzled out fast at Kansas. And they transferred to Houston, and he became more of an off-ball guy, really worked on his three-point shot, embraced the defensive side of the ball, and he truly transformed himself from someone who was looked at as a bigger point guard, quote unquote, to someone who became an off-ball player and has found a home and a career. And given how he's playing this year in Dallas, he's likely to get himself another extension. So, like, that, there are examples of players who have had to quit playing one way and have had to embrace an entirely different role. But it takes a lot from those players mentally. It takes a lot from them in terms of, you know, putting aside what they may have thought about themselves and just sacrificing for the good of themselves and for the good of the team. It takes a special person to do that. So kudos to both Payton and Brown and other stories like that who have succeeded in the NBA.
So before we wrap up the guard section, I just wanted to sort of bring this retrospective to bear in terms of the current draft class. And you know, the first guard that will be taken in this draft. I feel pretty confident in saying the first guard taken in this draft is going to be Dylan Harper out of Rutgers. And, you know, as a 6'6 point guard type, you know, on the one hand, this concept has existed since Magic Johnson, right? On the other hand, like, up until Ben Simmons was drafted at right at the start of the draft range that we're considering for this exercise, you know, LeBron was still considered a small forward. And, you know, I think most people would still consider LeBron as having played small forward. And, you know, maybe that's just sort of positional designation nomenclature that doesn't matter all that much. But I'm curious sort of your thoughts, you know, is this the kind of situation where maybe someone like Harper, you know, coming up, you know, does he maybe have the ball in his hands slightly less because he's viewed more as a wing in, you know, this is less 10 years ago and more 20 years ago. But is that, is this sort of evolution of big players being listed at point guard, is that just sort of a positional nomenclature thing? Or do you think there's something there to just bigger and bigger players being allowed to bring the ball up, being allowed to be ball handlers at a younger age rather than sort of, oh, you're the tallest kid on the team, you're going to be the center?
So it's a conversation that's certainly nuanced and there's multiple layers to it. I think where I come to in terms of the quote unquote bigger point guard discussion, I do certainly think that, you know, skill in the league nowadays has flattened more across positions. And when I say that, I mean, there's heightened importance no matter what position you are on the floor to be able to dribble, pass, shoot. So I think a lot of that skill crossover has certainly helped other positions be able to field different play types, be able to operate in different situations on the floor more so than I think in previous eras of the NBA. I think that's certainly something you can say. But in regards to someone like Dylan Harper being looked at as more of a guard than a wing, again, how I'm categorizing positions is I'm thinking about where Dylan Harper is likely to do most of his damage offensively. And he is someone, because of his ball handling, right? Because he is such a good ball handler, because he has that first step where he's able to get a step on the defense and able to collapse defenses and certainly break into the next layer, because he has that ball handling and that first step combination to where he can operate in the half court, but also going back to the ball handling, because he's actually someone who can literally bring the ball up the floor even when he's being pressured by other defenders. I think that's certainly lost in the equation when we look at some of these wings who we may think, oh, they're like primary facilitators. Can they be heliocentric players? Well, if they're being hounded by, you know, someone who is like, let's say like a Jose Alvarado, for example, or like a pesky guard defender who's going to stick at your hip and who's going to be able to poke the ball away from you, if you don't have a good handle, if you're turnover prone, you're not going to be looked at to me as a guard because you're not able to actually not only just initiate an action, whether you're coming off a secondary read, but you're able to actually bring the ball up the floor and say, hey, this is what we're going to do on offense, and I'm not going to be pressured and lose it before I even cross the half court line, right? So with someone like Dylan Harper, that's why I do look at him more of a guard compared to a traditional wing, because if I'm evaluating a wing, I'm thinking that he is literally going to start an action from the wings or from the corners. He's either going to relocate somewhere else or he's going to come off of another screening action and he's going to come catch the ball at the top of the key. And then it's up to there, you know, wherever the play goes, whether there's another action off of that or if it is a little bit motion oriented, read and react, where they have to make the decision immediately off of that. And then, you know, we'll see what happens from when the play goes from there. But that's how I view positions more so. And I think with someone like Dylan Harper, I think he's done enough at Rutgers to prove that he is worthy of high usage because he can take care of the basketball. He's not sloppy with it. He can make decisions. He can break down defenses, and you trust him to actually run an offense as opposed to, you know, he's a secondary or tertiary guy who's coming off of multiple different actions and he then has to make a decision with the ball in his hands. We'll talk about more of that stuff with wings, but I view Dylan Harper as a point guard, whether you want to classify him as a quote unquote big point guard or not. But he's somewhere in the 6'5", 6'6" realm. So he is above average size for a traditional NBA guard. But I don't view him in the same light as like a Luka Doncic, for example, who's like a 6'8", you know, 245, 250-pound guard. You know, that to me is more of an outlier. That's more skewing towards the Magic Johnson sense of bigger point guard. I think Dylan Harper is above average in size. But yeah, it really comes back to the ball handling and the decision-making for me. in terms of how they can actually facilitate an offense that define who a guard is more than some of those other characteristics.
This is fascinating to me, and you have blown my mind. So I'm going to try and, you know, stay somewhat on point here. But
oh, if we have to go multiple directions, like, come on, let's do it.
I well, there's hear your one thoughts. There's one key direction that I want to go in, which is I have always viewed the quote unquote positional spectrum thing not as where you play offensively, but where you who you defend, where you play defensively, and that I think, you know, maybe leads into the sort of fascination that I have with Gary Payton II, Bruce Barron archetype of someone who's, you know, a quote unquote one offensively because they're the smallest player in the lineup, but also sort of more of a four offensively because they're spending a lot of time in the dunker spot, setting a lot of screens, et cetera, et cetera. So that's fascinating to me that you sort of look at it in almost the opposite way of like where you're initiating offense from rather than who you're guarding.
Well, I think you have to split it both ways, right? I think sure. You have to find common ground and sort of meet in the middle because the defensive side of the ball absolutely is important, right? Like I'm calling a center because they're responsible for the middle of the floor. That goes on both offense and defense, right? A center is, you know, setting a screen, rolling, posting up in the paint, you know, and then on defense, they are obviously guarding in the lane. They're guarding the other team's big man, like. So when you look at it from that construct, obviously there's positional ties on both sides of the ball on offense. I mean, for guards on offense, again, I look at it as through that lens that I discussed. But on the other side, you know, a lot of those guys that you're calling quote unquote guards, you're not having them guard wings. You're not having them guard players who are 6'6", 6'7", 6'8", lining them up. So I think they kind of go a lot of the times they go hand in hand. But even someone like, let's take like a Luka Doncic, for example, right? Like Luka Doncic, no, he's not going to guard the other team's point guard, but he's probably guarding the other team's other backcourt player, right? Sometimes he's spending minutes defending on the three, you know, depending on the matchups, he might guard a four, but most of the time he's not guarding a five. He's not primarily asked to guard on the wing. He's guarding the other backcourt position. It's probably not spending most of his time guarding the other team's point guard. So like that's kind of what I'm talking about. We're like, yeah, I think looking at it through a defensive lens is as important as the offense, but I try and balance both of those lenses when I'm grading people out and sort of figuring out what position they are on the floor.
That's fair. I guess maybe, you know, speaking of that sort of meeting in the middle that you discussed, I mean,
do you think Dylan Harper's a wing or would you categorize him as a
guard? No, he's a point guard. He's a point guard, clearly. Okay. I just mean
so we're in agreement on it, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think part of it is sort of the, you know, and you mentioned Luka as a big guard type. And, you know, I think it sort of lends into the exact discussion that we were just having of, you know, do you consider LeBron James as having been a point guard? And, you know, given your sort of offense definition, you know, especially outside of his first few years in Cleveland, you know, given how much offense he initiated out of the post, right, those sorts of areas of the floor. But he was also bringing the ball up all the time, right? And that's, you know, more of a sort of quote unquote point guard in terms of your classification of, you know, he's not starting most of his actions on the wing if he's bringing the ball up. But that, I think, leads into the sort of very murky waters slash distinction between, you know, quote unquote heliocentric slash primary initiator and just the two-word label of point guard as opposed to small forward.
Sure. I mean, I would classify LeBron as a forward. I would, if we're going to really get into the nuts and bolts, I would consider him a point forward, you know, sure. And that again comes back to, you know, who is LeBron guarding on defense, right? He's not guarding the other team's point guard. He's guarding the other team's best three or four. And a lot of that was primarily because, you know, especially in his prime, LeBron was one of the best defensive players in the NBA. So yeah. You're going to ask him to guard the other team's best player. You're not, you know, if that is in fact a point guard, and LeBron found himself some minutes guarding a point guard, then so be it. But he was primarily matched up against other threes and fours. So I guess I see where you're going in terms of the pushback. That's why I say I think it's important to keep both of them in mind when we're defining positions. But we are in very murky waters, and that's not necessarily our fault. It's primarily because the NBA is becoming so positionless. And I think if you want to put a bow on a lot of this discussion in regards to positional archetypes and where we find ourselves in the NBA. I mean, there is so much positionless basketball being played, right? Because you have someone like Luka Doncic, who's 6'8", but he's primarily the team's point guard. You have Nikola Jokic, who is a center by all accounts, right? Like, he's guarding the other team's center. He's spending a lot of his time in the lane defensively, but yet on offense, he's the team's primary facilitator. Every single thing runs through Jokic. It's not just Jamal Murray's the point guard, but it's a lot about their two-man game and how Murray's playing off of Jokic, how Michael Porter Jr. is playing off of Jokic, Aaron Gordon's playing off of Jokic. Like, he is a point center, and it kind of breaks basketball, right? Like, we're not used to thinking about the game through that lens. Even Alperen Şengün with the Houston Rockets, right? It allows them to play some of these lineups where you have guys. It's not just about Fred VanVleet running the show. You have someone like Jalen Green playing off of Şengün. You have Amen Thompson and Tari Eason playing off of Şengün because he's able to command the ball at the top of the floor, and he has a respectable enough jump shot around the free throw line to where he can command that space. But he's also, you know, very crafty with the basketball. He can go into a post up. He can pass it off to somebody else, relocate, screen, work a handoff game, work a two-man game. Like, a lot of those big men, just I don't even want to get and fall into the trap and say that they couldn't have done that before, Nick. I just want to say that they weren't asked to do a lot of those things. There wasn't that same positional overlap. It wasn't, you know, important that a center was able to dribble the ball up the floor 94 feet if they had to, or worked from, you know, a three-point line when that was installed in the NBA. Like, those guys just weren't asked to do those things. A lot of the NBA game was built around having a dominant post score to where that opened things up for everyone else. And now that those big men have been able to drift further away from the basket, now that we have wings, someone like a Jason Tatum soaking up such high usage, you know, there's just so much to the game that has become quote unquote positionless, because a lot of these teams just have five guys who can dribble, pass, shoot, and defend. And that's what you have to deal with as an NBA coach trying to defend that other team. It's absolute hell. I won't even say it was ever a walk in the park, because the NBA is the best league in the world for basketball. But you know what I mean, right? It's never been tougher to defend in the NBA. So that, I mean, yeah. This philosophical discussion can go like 10 different ways, but.
This summer, I'm taking a new approach to styling the smallest spaces in my house with help from Bob's Discount Furniture. Bob's has the small space solutions that America's waited 250 years for, like retro chic bedroom sets with plenty of storage, dinner party ready dining sets in four fun colors, stylish, spacious Bobopedic sofas, and feature packed power recliners that let me kick back in even the smallest rooms. Plus, I know that Bob's styles are backed by thousands of real 5-star customer reviews, so I can trust that the furniture that I'm getting is not just affordable, but built to last. And the best part? Bob's Furniture ships fast, so I can enjoy my new styles all summer long. So when you're ready to ditch the furniture you're not excited about for the latest trends in small space styling, stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
Well, in that case, let's circle back to where we began and talk about some of the smaller guards in this class and how the sort of evolution of the NBA over the last 10 years has maybe affected their prospects. And I want to sort of drill in specifically on Tahad Pettiford and John Mobley Jr., who are, let's just say, generously listed at 6 foot and 6'1". And, you know, this is the kind of thing where, just even in the scope of this exercise, I mean, three of the top 13 players taken in the 2018 draft were 6'2 or shorter guards. And, you know, one of them was obviously a very good selection in Trae Young. One of them was a quite good selection in Colin Sexton. And Jerome Robinson is the reason why I want to sort of bring it back to this discussion, because I don't mean to be unkind to Jerome or his family, but, you know, I don't think that the kind of player that he was gets drafted at 13 unless they're, you know, Trae Young level of special, or even Colin Sexton level of special, as, you know, someone who's been a long-term NBA starter and certainly seems like he's going to have a 10 plus year NBA career barring injury. But with Pettiford and John Mobley, I believe Mobley was 48th on our most recent big board. I don't remember off the top of my head where Pettiford was, but probably somewhere in that second round range. And just sort of given how high of a baseline they have to clear offensively, given the defensive limitations that they're going to have, given their size, how, first of all, how good do you think they have to be to stick around in the NBA? And second of all, how different do you think that is than if they were in, say, the 2015 draft class instead?
So John Mobley Jr. can shoot on an NBA floor right now. And Todd Pettiford can score on an NBA floor right now. But the difference in drafting them, you know, in the first round, you're looking at them as potential starting guards. And in order for them at their size to command a starting point guard job is, again, going to come to the feel and their decision making and how they actually run an NBA offense. And when I talk about a lot of that stuff, it's not obviously their threats to score and shoot, but it also comes back to, you know, what types of decisions are they making on the floor? Do they understand how to operate within an offense in the sense of getting their teammates the ball at the right times, you know, making sure that they're raising the floors of others, getting everyone else involved before themselves, not just assist hunting, actually making the next play the right play. That type of point guard play is what I'm referring to when we're talking about can either of those guys be starters in the NBA. That type of decision making from that spot. Again, if you're a point guard in the NBA, you're probably soaking up a fair share of usage within your team's offense. And if you're going to soak up a high level of usage just because of how the game's played today, it's a lot of read and react. Are you making the best decisions? Can you get everyone else, you know, pull those different types of levers? You know, even when you talk to some of the best point guards who have come into the league, like you've heard guys like Chris Paul and Steve Nash and Jason Kidd talk about this. It's about, you know, the feel and the temperament of the offense. You know, if they know that someone else is cooking, how can I get them the ball? Or if, you know, someone else isn't cooking, right? If one of their teammates who they know can be a go-to scorer, one of the guys who, when their offense is humming, the entire team's offense is humming, how can I get them the ball in their spots to where they're most effective, to actually make them the best versions of themselves? You know, I watch a guy like Tahad, or I watch a guy like John Mobley Jr. Actually, Corey and I got to scout John Mobley Jr. at Madison Square Garden. Like, obviously, the talent is there for him to be able to put the ball in the basket from virtually wherever spot the court he wants. Like, when we say, like, when I say John Mobley Jr. is parking lot range, like, I freaking mean it. Like, the dude has parking lot range. But there's more nuance that's required from, you know, playing the point guard position in the NBA today. And I think that's an important characteristic of when we're evaluating these guys who, you know, can they go top 10? Can they go top 20? Are they first round guys? Are they better off being drafted in the second round, getting on a two-way contract, proving what they can in the G League to then earn an NBA standard contract? Those are the differences, right? Like, I can point to, for every one guard you want to give me in this draft class who can score and shoot the heck out of the ball, I can probably give you 3, 4, 5, 6 names in the G League who have that same type of ability. But the reason why they're in the G League and they're not in the NBA right now is because they're probably not the same level of decision maker that I ran off in terms of some of those names where I said I had 30 NBA guards at 6'3" or under. It's not their size that's defining how good they are. It's because you can trust guys like Steph Curry, John Morant, Jalen Brunson with the ball in their hands to either not only just score, but also make the right play for the next man and balance the offense, playing with the basketball or playing without the basketball. So, like, that to me is a separator for guys like Tahad and John Mobley, and why I'm interested in following their evolution as guards, not even just for this draft, but potentially for drafts ahead, is how do they actually evolve as floor generals and decision makers, and how do they end up orchestrating offenses? Because I've seen flashes of them both do it. And you're by the way, you're free to push back on me wherever with both of those guys. I don't know where they're at on your boards or where you have their evaluations for you. But that to me will be the next thing for them, is can I actually trust them to sort of pull the levers and make sure everyone's operating at their best and raising the floors of those around them and making those decisions at the next level?
So to answer the last question that you posed, I'm slightly higher on both of them than the no ceilings consensus, but okay, not dramatically. I don't have either of them as first rounders at this point, and it's mainly just sort of what you already mentioned. The bar for guards of that size is so high. And, you know, as you mentioned, there are a ton of guys in the G League who, you know, can score at an incredibly high level, but aren't the Ja Morants, the Trae Youngs, the Darius Garlands, the De'Aaron Foxes, the Steph Currys, you know, the names that you list off. Like, essentially, either you're like an all-star level guard, you're a highly coveted, you know, sort of six-man slash rotation player off the bench, or, as you mentioned, you're in the G League. And, you know, combine that with how high the defensive bar has to be for guards that are that undersized. And, you know, it's a difficult proposition in sort of the modern NBA to put them in a first round, even though I love watching them play. And, you know, I'm certainly, I mean, you know, by definition, given that I'm higher on them than the No Ceilings consensus, I believe in them more than the average No Ceilings scout. But even still, I don't have either of them in my first round. And those are the sort of main reasons why, just how high the offensive bar is and how high the defensive bar is also.
100%. And even when we're watching a guy who, you know, we all hold near and dear to our hearts in terms of refilling our draft boards. But look at someone like Scoot Henderson, Nick. Like Scoot Henderson, there might not have been one person on media platforms who actually wanted to talk about the NBA draft who spoke highly of Scoot as much as I did or sang his praises as much as I did. And yet, look at where he's been for the Portland Trailblazers. It's been a very mixed bag, and a lot of it comes back to not necessarily his ability to score the basketball, because he could put the ball in the basket. He's actually done a lot better over the last, you know, 5-6 games or so at actually getting to the free throw line and making that a bigger part of his game, embracing physicality. When he gets those paint touches, you know, is he actually capitalizing on them? It's not even just about the outside shot. You know, he's had a lot of spells where his turnovers have just been absolutely egregious compared to, you know, some of the stuff that we even saw in his very early time in the G League. I know his second season in the G League, that was a big criticism of evaluators when we were talking about him versus Brandon Miller, was, you know, which Scoot Henderson are we going to get? Are we going to get the guy who is much better at taking care of the basketball and scoring more efficiently in his first year in the G League? Or are we going to get the guy who may have had some injury problems the second season of the G League, but you saw a lot of that turnover stuff show up on the film the second year of the G League too. And it's that bar of decision-making that can really set guys apart. And when you see some of these players struggle, even when they're held in such high regards, like Scoot Henderson, he falls in that camp of, he's not a plus size in terms of height guard, but he is built like a bull. He's built like a freaking ox, man. Like, that dude is strong as hell. So it's not necessarily about the physical ability for him. Yeah, he's had his trouble shooting the basketball from three-point range, but he has mid-range ability. He has the ability to hit a floater. He can finish around the basket. A lot of the stuff with him, and you'll hear even people who talk about the Portland Trailblazers who cover the team, like when I talked to Danny Morang before the season started, like one of his biggest things was, you know, Scoot's decision-making and his turnovers were a big issue. And that can really separate guys. And that's again, a big part in, you know, are you an NBA starting point guard? Can you actually take care of the basketball? Can a coach trust you to make the decisions for everyone else? Or are you just on the court to get yours? Because if you're just on the court to get yours, you may get an opportunity because of how good you are, but eventually, you know, the dam's going to break. And there's going to be a point where you're questioning, is this guy actually our point guard, our starter, someone who we're putting on the floor 30 plus minutes a night to lead our offense? Or are we bringing him off the bench? Or is he even an NBA guard altogether? And that, to me, has continued to be, in all of my evaluations and research, the biggest separators of the guys who are the best at their profession and the guys who end up struggling or ultimately fizzle out of the NBA.
All right. Anything else you want to bring up before we wrap up the guard section here?
No, I think that was an excellent last stand on my soapbox, Nick. But I thank you for letting me get out some of these thoughts on guards and as we talk about some of this archetype stuff, because it is really interesting, right? And what you led with off the top of the show, you know, we need to evaluate for the league that we're evaluating for properly. And that means we're paying attention to what's going on in the NBA. That means we're watching NBA games. That means we're paying attention to what's going on in the G League, comparing and contrasting who's actually making it, who's not. Where do those characteristics blend? Where do they separate? And I think a lot of what we talked about today is certainly good information for anyone out there as they're continuing to try to study player evaluation and figure out what's going on at the guard spot.
All right, so that will do it for us for today's episode. Thank you so much to Nathan Grubel for joining me. You can find him on Twitter at DraftDeeper, and you can, of course, find his written work at NoCeilingsNBA.com. You can find me on social media on Blue Sky at NBA Johnson, and you can also find me on Twitter at NBA Johnson. If you've been enjoying the podcast, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you're using. And since this episode and part two following it will be slight deviations from the usual format for the Deep Dives podcast. If you have any feedback on that, please let me know. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
This is the sound of captivity. This is the sound of rescue. And this is the sound of freedom. Give Armenia's captive bears a second chance by supporting International Animal Rescue. Call 508-826-1083 or search The Great Bear Rescue to learn more.